I want to welcome everybody. This is the first lecture of this term in our series, our Global Civil Society series. Part of the purpose of the series is to promote the Global Civil Society yearbook, which our program produces here at LSE, but also just to discuss the issues that are contained in it. And in this year's yearbook, the first one was produced a year ago, we have a wonderful chapter written by Hokan on AIDS, HIV activism. And one of the nice things about doing a yearbook on global civil society is it's a way of looking at global issues from a different perspective, from those people who are campaigning on them. And I think this is a great chapter, and we thought it would be really nice to have a discussion about the issues involved so people can become interested and to pursue some of the themes in the chapter. So our speakers are Hokan Sekin Elgin, who wrote the chapter, and then we have Vina O'Sullivan, who worked in India with international NGOs on HIV/AIDS, and now she's the HIV/AIDS coordinator in the TIER Fund. And then Birgit Kenem, who works for the John Hopkins Center for Communications Program in Rwanda. So we're very pleased to have them both, and we'll start with Hokan.
Can you hear me if I speak here? Okay, but I have to stand up first.
I think it's better to stand up, actually. Yeah, I think it's good to go there. But you don't have to.
I might carry the away, though.
You don't have to, but everybody can see you.
I wanted to start with pointing out the facts about HIV/AIDS in terms of where we are. These are statistics from the recent AIDS epidemic update from the United Nations AIDS program. So as you see, we have adults and children estimated to be living with HIV/AIDS at the end of the year in the region of 42 million people in total. And the second statistic, again in the same report, is about the infections in the last year. And they're talking about 5 million new infections. This sort of statistic, which sort of pushed me to think about what is happening in reality, because this is a very horrendous picture, and yet we know a huge amount of effort put into dealing with HIV/AIDS, as well as a lot of money put into it. And so I was trying to see what is happening, why so much money, so much effort, and so many people are still living with it and dying and being infected every day. I'll just do about two main points of the discussion to give you a taste of the chapter. I think in the research I came across with the fact that HIV/AIDS debate is highly what you call medicalized, i.e. that a lot of effort and money is spent on how to get people into hospitals, or how to get vaccination procedures established and get vaccine sort of discovered, if you like. So a huge amount of effort being spent on these issues. However, AIDS is a disease which in fact highlights entire social problems in society. You have problems in relation to social exclusion, gender differences, poverty, ethnic divisions, rural-urban divide, as well as problems of rapid liberalization and economic changes in countries. All these conditions, social conditions by and large, are instrumental in the spread of the disease in most of the cases and in most of the places. Now, these issues seem to me, at least, although are acknowledged, are not paid attention or spend money on as much as some other tangible issues like sensitization, which is important, but overdoing it has its important problems as well. Now, the second issue is much more related with the Global Civil Society yearbook, is the involvement of the global civil society actors, which can be seen in this particular context, by and large international NGOs. Civil society has been very important in the development of ways of dealing with HIV/AIDS in the industrialized countries in the early 80s. Without civil society, probably HIV/AIDS wouldn't have been put into the agenda, political agenda of countries. However, this civil society activism is very different from what we see today in the developing countries, and as you can see, where the major problems are located. One of the reasons for this, what I call in the chapter, the difference between what is called now, in terms of the organizational structure, global civil society, i.e. international NGOs, by and large, and the people's politics, and people's politics creating the civil society action. Clearly there are important examples of this kind of action taking place in the South at the moment. One extremely important and probably groundbreaking example is the treatment action campaigns, both in South Africa, Thailand, and Brazil, and how they coordinated their effort to fight the pharmaceuticals to back down using generic drugs. So we have a sort of emergence of people's politics by expressed, as they are expressing themselves, their needs in the way they want to talk about it. And also in Rwanda, the widows of the genocide, the way they are organized and trying to address the way they face HIV, which is a particular way, unique probably to Rwanda, are very important examples, but they are really rare cases, if you like. Because most of the civil society action today in the South is about international NGOs intervening in projects and in programs based on funding from external donors. Therefore, most of the interventions are time-limited and extremely sort of measured according to their outcome. So those constraints are influencing how they can engage with the needs of the people as they express themselves. So these are two sides of the discussion. My sort of problem, if you like, I have a problem with this setup, obviously, is in the disjuncture of these two things. AIDS is a social problem with multiple layers, and the agents who are engaging with the disease are external to that social context and trying to make sense of the problem from their own perspective. Now, we have a problem here, and the issue today, I mean, that's sort of where the title of the talk comes from, or the roundtable comes from, Stop and Think. We need to think, how on earth are we going to address these issues, which are extremely specific to social, economic, and cultural contexts in the way they are experienced, with some sort of external help without dominating what should be done. So I think I just want to end by saying there is an urgent need to think what can be done without being pressured into what is tangible in the existing system. We have to start thinking quite differently than the way we've been thinking about how one would intervene into HIV/AIDS. Thank you.
So let us hope we will hear a little bit about how we can think differently. And first I'll ask Bina if she'd like to speak.
I hope you don't mind, I'd prefer to sit down. Well, I think I am from India, and I've lived in this country for 3 years now. Worked in India with a local group addressing the issue of HIV and AIDS, which is a huge problem back home. And when I first came here, I volunteered at the London Lighthouse, which many of you may know about. And to me, the face of HIV here was totally different from what I had experienced or seen back home. And the contrast just hits you so much when you see people look so different, or you know, their issues are so different. Well, after coming here, and I've been working with an international NGO called Tear Fund, and we work in many countries overseas, and It's amazing to see how most of the work has been hijacked by this one issue. And as you travel around, and this is a personal experience, I think the whole issue of HIV and priorities is quite subjective. If I was sitting here and I was HIV positive, I'd be fighting for drugs, but I'm in a different position, so my perspective is of a different, of an outsider in many ways, trying to help communities meet their needs. But what strikes me is the whole fact that the whole issue of HIV goes back to very foundations. It's a relational virus that's passed on because of relationships. And there's a lot of broken foundations, be it economic, social, political, or, you know, anywhere you go. And that doesn't change. The nature of the disease may look different in different countries, but the issues or the things that facilitate the spread of the virus are similar. It's all down to poverty primarily. And just come back from a trip to Southern Africa. As you know, Southern Africa's struggling with this whole food crisis, and most of the agencies like us went in there with a lot of food to distribute and things like that. But everyone's come back struggling with how do we address the orphan issue, how do we address the whole issue of supporting grandmothers to care for the 35 and 27 children that they each one of them cares about. And it again comes down to the fact that they don't have money, they don't have food, and they really aren't thinking about drugs at this point. They want to know, can we have dinner tonight? Can we think of education for the children? I think it's one of those that, again, it's down to the basics, really, in terms of food and shelter and security. And, yeah, it's, I mean, that's the whole struggle. And as working with an agency, you just think, we haven't done our work, obviously. And we're thinking now of getting back to the basics and addressing basic needs. And we're thinking now of capacity building issues for people to address these needs. So it really is a struggle, and in each place it's you're actually dealing with the same issues of addressing poverty, of addressing the need for increased income, the economic side to things, and that's my experience on this whole thing. And yeah, I don't know if you want to ask anything. I don't know what you'd like to hear.
Why don't we ask Birgit to add something, and then people could okay. ask questions.
Thank you. Maybe just to say that I'm no longer working in Rwanda because I've come back now to Paris, but I'm still linking with Africa, going there often. So that was just kind of information. First of all, I would like to say that there are several AIDS epidemics. When you are sick, you are an AIDS patient in the north, it's not the same as when you are an AIDS patient in developing countries. It means that there is, when you are in Europe, in France, or whatever, in a rich country, if I can use this word, you have access to drugs. You have a social security system to afford your all the expenses related to care and things like that. You can access to condoms, but in Africa it's totally different. So that's why it's important to say that there are several AIDS epidemics, and where you are coming from will impact on the way you will survive to the disease or the way you will cope with the disease. It's true that AIDS is a social problem, it's a developmental problem, it's an epidemic, it's a gender. You can see it also as a gender-based perspective. It's also a matter of poverty. When you have people living with HIV/AIDS in Africa, they die easily, if I can say it like that, because they don't eat properly. The drugs that you have to take because of HIV/AIDS, you need to be very well fed, and if you don't, you cannot eat properly. Definitely, it will impact on the quality of the treatment and the way you will be able to cope with the disease. So this is important to say, but I think that it brings me also to what Hakan was saying about the international NGOs intervening in those countries, linking with local NGOs in the continent. What is happening also is that the money is in the north and the disease is in the south. It doesn't mean that there are no sick persons in Europe or in developed countries. It's just that most of the AIDS patients, as you can see on the diapositive, are in the poor, underdeveloped countries. So that's an issue that needs to be addressed also. Because what is happening, even if people express their needs and say, we need that, we need to have to access the drugs. And if you are aware of what's happening now with the most of the African countries are trying to access to the generics. You say generics also? Yes. And but right now it's a little bit difficult, quite impossible for them to access to those generics because of the how do you say, OMC? Yeah. So all these problems are very important, and it shows that if you are poor, you will die from AIDS more rapidly than somebody who is rich. That is definitely clear. Regarding the way the international donors or NGOs work in Africa, they are bringing the money. They are sometimes also bringing the capacities, the skills, and things like that. They are also funded by government or private donors or whatever, but they also have their own expectations. They also have to produce report and to explain how they have used the money, how many people, and to give statistics or how do you call that, results. They have to give results and things like that. And sometimes it's not so easy to match the reality or the what people are experiencing or the needs of the people or the target groups. It's not easy to match those needs with the expectations of the NGOs who are on the field. And definitely, as I can mention, we have to rethink the way to intervene on the field and to see how beyond capacity building, what power, if I can use this word, can be not given, but how these local NGOs can be more effective on the field and decide more for themselves. I can understand Akan's position when he mentioned medicalization, vaccines, and so on, but you need to link prevention to care. Now you have you have television everywhere in Africa, even in some villages which are so far. So people look, they watch TV, they see the last movies, but they see also that NGOs like ACT UP or whatever, they are fighting to access to treatment. So why they should, because they are a sick person in a poor country, why they shouldn't access to drugs? So this is also globalization. Sorry, so it's the same. So the information, you cannot keep the information somewhere as long as you develop all the means of communication and things like that. And people move along with that, even if they are poor, they want to access to a better life, to education, to generics or treatment against AIDS. So this is something we cannot go against that. And I think that this is important, and we have to link prevention to care. We have also to look at all the gender aspects of these epidemics or all the reproductive health needs in general. We also have to look at social or economical problems, because as you mentioned, it is linked to poverty. We also have to look to political environment also, because in many countries, actually in Africa, we are facing war. In Rwanda, we had a big genocide, and women were raped during the genocide, and because of this rape, many of them got infected by HIV/AIDS. So we see that to address the AIDS epidemic, we have to address so many aspects, political aspects, economical aspects, health issues, prevention, and things like that. So right now, I will stop there, maybe.
I'm going to ask questions, but I'd like to ask both Dina and Birgit to say a little bit about whether they think there's a good cooperation between local political actors and NGOs, or whether they think it's a problem, and maybe to give us a few examples of local actors.
I think there's a lot happening on the ground within communities. I think the amazing thing is, you know, people have their sense of right and wrong and how to deal with a situation, whether they've been educated or not. And more often than not, they come up with the best ideas, which we wouldn't have never thought of. Very simple, practical things. I think communities have the ability to solve their problems. The question of resource is very key in all that, and question of a role for someone to facilitate them, to help them think through solutions is really important. And the whole thing of just sharing with each other, because so often there are people are so isolated, even though we're talking about a globalized world. I think people are still isolated in terms of knowledge, in terms of experiences, and they think, oh, only I have this problem. But we have a role in bringing people together to help them share, to help them, you know, just share their experiences and the solutions they've come up with. Politically, unfortunately, I take a backseat on that, because I think working with an international NGO, we are struggling to keep the momentum of on the interest of HIV with Iraq. Previously with Afghanistan, and it is so hard to keep the interest of governments on an issue like this, which is going to really cause more and more problems or create more and more adverse situations in the future, and that's a huge challenge. You know about the Global Fund, which was set up primarily for HIV, TB, and malaria, and the whole idea at the beginning was that local NGOs would be able to access money from the Global Fund and specifically to, you know, for interventions. But it's one of the hardest things to get into. I mean, the board of the Global Fund primarily, they have two vacancies for NGOs. And that's it. The rest of them are businessmen, they're political people. And even the two vacancies, they recently sent around an email saying, would anyone like to nominate people for these two positions? But they would just be advisory. So in terms of actually to have influence, there's a huge question mark. And I don't know, many of you know Peter Piot, who used to be who is the head of UNAIDS, is actually moving on to WHO, and which is, he's struggled, I think, enough at the UNAIDS job in trying to mobilize resources. So it's like it's an ongoing battle with governments. And even at the way, for example, DFID works now, they will work with the Indian government. They will not fund an NGO directly. And that's when your doors are closed. Because if you, when I met the DFID people in India, in Delhi, and I said, why are you working only through the government? If you believe you want capacity to build the government, keep some money aside for the government, but keep some money aside where you can actually get work going by funding local groups. And they just laughed and they said, yeah, we know it's such a pain to work with the government, but we are stuck, our hands are tied. So you hit that door time and again, and it is really frustrating, because good work is happening, but because this is like an emergency situation, I mean, the numbers are just phenomenal, and the countries are phenomenal. We're now looking at China, which is going to be one of the biggest challenges, because I don't think any donor can dictate how the Chinese government has to respond. And already most of the international governments are struggling with this dialogue with the Chinese people, and it'll be interesting to see how that works out. Yeah.
I think that you are right, huh? But there are many things happening on the ground with local NGOs. They are doing there are very positive experiences happening on the field. I think that, as you mentioned, it's a matter of lack of resources and being able to bring those experiences to scaling them up. That's the issue. And in some countries also, it's not so easy to work with sometimes international NGOs prefer to work or to subcontract with local NGOs rather than with the government, because they are afraid that the money may be misused or things like that. But it's also difficult to say that you will give support to a country in the fight against AIDS or any disease, and trying to avoid him when you try to set up the interventions on the field. So it's not so easy. We have also to take into account all these political aspects. Most of the time, they are not helpful, because it makes things slow. It slows things down, and it doesn't help things to move on. And that's a problem. But I think that's also international NGOs must also see how they can reinforce the capacities of the local NGOs. So they, as you mentioned, most of the activities are time, or projects are time limited. So when an international NGO pack of no more projects, no more money, and the NGOs also stop its activities, even if they were really addressing real needs and things like that. So I think this is also a big issue.
Hi, can you hear me? You all have spoken on how different it is to be HIV positive in the north and in the south, developed and developing countries. And certainly one of the reasons for that, beyond just wealth, is the different approaches of varying national governments, some of whom, of course, ignore the problem or avoid the problem to some extent. Thabo Mbeki is probably the most egregious, conspicuous example, but certainly India, China, those governments have received a lot of criticism for their failure, at least, to address this problem pretty effectively. And my question for you, coming largely from the NGO community, is who's the best voice to address these governments, to change their policies? Is it NGOs? Is it other foreign governments? Is it the UN, UNAIDS, WHO? What's the best way of changing these attitudes, in particular in cases like India and China that are going to be such phenomenal numbers, surely?
I'll speak for India. I think international pressure has worked. The World Bank came and gave one of the states, I think, $500 million in 1995, it was, for a three-year program. The state government guys just sat on it for 2 years, and the World Bank said, give us the money back, and then they got all the money out to make videos and some horrendous stuff. So international pressure worked in the sense it put pressure on them internationally, because for an economy that was opening up and looking for investment, foreign investment, it's always a give and take. Like Bill Gates went a couple of months ago, and the US ambassador in Delhi made a lot of noise about how the government was really bad in addressing the HIV issue. The health minister for India shouted at the US ambassador and told Bill Gates, give me the money, we'll do something about it. So it's a catch-22 situation. There is a role for external pressure, but if you're asking whether it's going to actually get the government moving effectively, question mark. But I think there is a role for local pressure too. All the players, it can't just be the NGO community, because the NGO community anyway is quite marginalized because they think you all are all just activists, you know, you want to shout at everything. So I think you need all the players. You need the doctors, the medical fraternity especially, because they're the care, you know, provide care so often. You need schools, you need the political figures, people of standing, and you need the NGOs and the people who are affected. So unless there's a coalition, it's hard to just get one group to get them to do things.
Yes. As she said, everybody has to be part of the process and the fight. And if you see the people living with the associations of people living with HIV/AIDS, when they are strong in the countries where they are strong and they can have their voice heard, they are able to put some pressure on the government. But it's not enough, but it helps a lot. But in our continent, when you see the NGOs, the PLWA at the beginning, now it's changing. Some of them are networking. They are more or less, you have more or less strong NGOs now. But at the beginning, they were weak, and they couldn't put enough pressure on the government. But it's a bit more.
I think I totally agree. It has to be. Is this making sense? It has to be coalition, which is pressurizing the government to do, or government or pharmaceuticals, whoever you are dealing with it. But it is the power of the coalition usually seems to be related with people with HIV/AIDS actually shouting about. If you are supporting those people who are really asking for their livelihoods, that we need drugs or we need whatever they need, and they are supported somehow by all sorts of actors around them, that voice is really important. And support in the case of, what I'm suggesting in a way, civil society in action, that's how it happened in the North. And if you look at the early 80s in the US, it was doctors, medical profession, those people who are supporting people living and dying from AIDS. So, and that the same pattern is sort of replicated in the South African case. If you look at South African case, the person, the leader of the group, was refusing to use any medication until such time that the government provides everyone with the same drug, is supported by quite a large number of groups, including the most strongest, one of the most politically strongest groups in the country, which is the trade union movement in South African context, as well as international and local NGOs. So I think that sort of coalition seems to be much, much more important than your WHOs, UNAIDS, United Nations taking a sort of making a statement about how important AIDS is, because those things are not going anywhere, because you can easily ignore them.
There's just one thing, though, I feel strongly about. It's an international government cannot come and tell, say, for example, the government of Malawi, saying that you need to scale up, you need to do better, you know, at your HIV/AIDS response, when they haven't cancelled the debt, which the Malawian government is paying so much towards international debt that even if they had 25% of that money for themselves, they could scale up. So it's, I think that it's lots of things that need to be done.
Maybe one should have a campaign around debt for aid, something, you know, they have debt equity swaps and debt, why not a debt for assistance?
You talked about the effectiveness of the NGO programs and the government programs, and I just wondered what your opinion was about mainstreaming HIV into all development programs and whether that would create more pressure for things to actually happen.
Yeah.
I think there is a problem with that. This is like old-style mainstreaming fashions in NGO development community. You mainstream first in 1970s environment, and then 1980s you mainstream gender, and now major issue HIV/AIDS, we mainstream HIV/AIDS. But in most cases, mainstreaming seems to mean that in order to get donor funding, you have to show that you are actually involved in that particular area. So it becomes fashion, as well as an image that you can actually use as a tool rather than something you really engage in and sort of try to come up with extremely sensible policies. You just do it as a matter of fact, just to show it. So that's sort of my approach.
As you said, mainstreaming gender or mainstreaming HIV AIDS in all the development program. There are two or three things that can be done to address several issues at the same time, because we know that people, if they don't have access to education, if a girl is not well educated, she won't take care properly of her kids, she will have problems when she will get pregnant, or the parents, if they are poor, they will get their daughter in early marriage, so early pregnancy and all sorts of reproductive health problems. So by solving poverty or making people having access to education and having career opportunities, it may change also the situation. And regarding AIDS also, they will have they will be less at risk regarding AIDS or STIs and things like that.
Or shall I go to another person? More questions?
Okay.
What's up there? Just bringing
in. There have been some sorts of success from building perfect place against the HIV as well as global silver, which have an effect on Australian virus. Do you have any more comments on that?
Herbal remedy.
Especially in Central Africa, there's quite a lot of herbs there. People are experts.
It's a difficult one, I think, because scientifically, a lot of it hasn't been proven. But there are lots of stories about different cures or, you know, different remedies. And it's hard to promote anything or base your, you know, fact on anything unless it's a proven thing. But in saying that, there are lots of traditional medicines that help build up the immunity, and those are, you know, things that we can look to, yeah, to help people live healthier longer. There are lots of herbal remedies for certain opportunistic infections, and those we can look to, but as a cure for HIV itself, I don't think so.
There is an actual group which I sort of looked at, which is called Traditional and Modern Health Practitioners Together Against AIDS and Other Diseases. These people are trying to use those herbal medicine, which is sort of useful for some of the opportunistic diseases, to apply them in a manner which sort of serves the interests of whoever is the disease, sort of person with the disease. However, there is a problem with not with the project, but the general context of it, because as soon as something is useful for one of these opportunistic diseases, you get big pharmaceuticals turning up to buy the rights to produce and use those herbal medicine, and the end result, of course, is going to be creating the pill and selling the pill back to Africa or the people who are in need. And then you just are facing a situation where the entire, you know, the social context we've been sort of discussing is replicated. Poverty, exclusion, all these things.
Other questions?
Of children being orphaned and how the countries are responding to it.
If I take the Rwandan situation, actually the country, it's difficult for the government to address this issue. When I was still working there, actually there were more than 3,000 street kids because orphanage by AIDS. There was the war, the genocide, but AIDS also. Most of them, more than 50% of those kids have lost the two parents, and they found themselves in the street. And at other statistics were showing that at by the age of 8 or 12 years old, some of them, not a small percentage, has already been involved in sexual intercourse. Some of them have been also raped and things like that. So it's really a big issue, and they don't know how to deal with that. And what happened also is that the government was taking those kids and bringing them inside the country, not having them in town, because everybody is against those children, saying that they are stealing, they are making all sorts of things, and nobody is taking care of them. And right now, there is a need to work first on the perception of people on those kids first, before involving people to try to find solution and to help those kids. But right now is really difficult. I hope it's coming.
I've just come back from a trip to Mozambique, Zambia, South Africa, and it's shocking to see villages with just children. Just children and children everywhere, and a few old people. You just don't see people in the middle age group at all, and that's one of the most frightening things about the future, is how vulnerable these children are going to be, in terms of in their growing up, in how they're going to protect themselves. It's a huge, huge problem. Maybe something like when you go to Cambodia, you don't see older people because of the Pol Pot regime. Here you don't see middle-aged people, you can see children.
I just want to actually suggest the orphans and the situation they are in is a very interesting point, which demonstrates the way the entire disease has been dealt with in those contexts, because orphans, or even some big NGO, international NGOs who are dealing with children, has become an issue only 6-8 months ago, and they start to deal with it. And my question is, what stopped people working with children to realize this was on the making and it was actually happening? It's a very curious question.
I was wondering, does that have to do with patterns of activism? Mm. I was just wondering, and it was going to be another question I wanted to ask all of you. Do you see areas which are more or less active, not because of the level of AIDS or HIV, but because of historical conditions, and how, what is the impact? And I suppose subsidiary to that question is something that I know you've thought about, which is that in northern countries, HIV AIDS activism has very much come out of the gay community, whereas that's very different in the south, and what have been the cultural problems of relating these two points of AIDS?
I think it is very important that have to point out HIV/AIDS activism in the industrialized countries came out of gay and lesbian movements by and large in the US and the UK to shift the politics. But having said that, despite their importance and all their sort of involvement with it, the impact of that fact influenced the initial reaction of the particularly African countries. In Kenya, initially, people refused the disease on the basis of its group of people who are infected by it. They said this sort of behavior doesn't exist in our culture, so it's not our problem. So in a way, if you like, maybe what I call sort of over-medicalization of it, or the involvement in certain areas like sort of overkill with condomization of the entire continent nearly, is related with the fact that those areas were the only available activity spaces without creating a political fuss about it.
I don't know, I mean, I think there is an argument for that, that that's some available space for activism in itself.
I think also that maybe you want to say something related to that.
I'm a student here of social policy, and I was involved with AIDS activism for a long time, so now I'm beginning to feel guilty because I haven't said anything until this point. And I think what you just said, Mary, is very, very important. Thank you for being here. It's very helpful for me in my own personal struggle. But, you know, I think one of the things that happens to me in these debates is that, you know, the most, as it were, successful route of transmission of HIV is unprotected sex. And I have to say that, you know, well, gay men are much better at talking about it, basically. And, you know, when you said that, I think that's a really fundamental issue, that I don't actually think it was only about the fact that there is more money in the North. I think also women are not, you know, we're not encouraged to speak about this issue, which is absolutely fundamental. You know, we're not empowered to say, you know, no. I mean, I'm a woman in the North, and I don't feel I can really, you know, say no when I need to sometimes. So God knows if you're impoverished and so on and so on. And, you know, I was at the World AIDS Conference in Durban, and I have to say that I was completely obliterated by one session around the violence issue. And I just got a sense of huge, you know, that, you know, it was kind of like every man in that room must have been feeling terrible guilt. But I thought to myself, well, this isn't normal behavior. You know, it is not normal that people go around, you know, assaulting and raping. I don't think it is, anyway. But it does, it did occur to me that, you know, the gender issue and the inequality there is so deep and needs such a lot of energy addressed to it. And the whole, you know, because it's almost as if somehow heterosexuality has become marginalized, not in the South, but certainly, you know, because the powerful known, apart from South Africa, I must admit, I'm ignorant as well, I don't know the whole story, but apart from a lot of powerful, you know, public activism around that gay men were able to do in North America and other bits of Europe, and I'm sure other parts of the world generally, you know, this issue was never really brought onto the agenda in a way that I think it could be. Now, you know, I've always worked, you know, my focus has been injection drug use, which, you know, looking at use is going to be a mess. But I don't know if anyone in the NGOs wants to say anything about that, because I think it would be...
Yeah. What I wanted... First, remember when the epidemic, the AIDS epidemic started in Europe, you had these 4 H, you heard about the 4 H, the gay, homosexual, gay, Haitian, people from Haiti, people using intravenous, the intravenous drug users. Actually, the H are in French, huh? And the fourth one, on man, Haitian.
Hemophiliacs.
Exactly. So when, because of this categorization, some people felt that they were not at risk of the disease. And there has been a long period of denial. And also, what happened also in Africa, and I remember in Zaire at that time, now it's Democratic Republic of Congo, the people said that AIDS was something, was a syndrome created by European people. Just to put it aside as a family planning or condom, saying that European people wanted them to stop having child, to stop having children. So when I say that, it's also to say, to put that to keep that in mind, because it also explains the delay in some countries, why people couldn't, or government didn't react immediately. And at the same time, as it was not particular groups which were concerned by the disease, but in Africa, as you say, it's heterosexual transmission, so it's people who, the countries were kind of overwhelmed, because almost everybody in quotes is concerned by the disease or can be infected. So that's the difference also, and I think it's important to talk about that. Regarding gender, I agree with you, but at the same time, I think that you find also violence in couples. You find it in the north, in the south. It's not to make to say that the north is like this or the south. It's just to explain that because of different factors, you have to factor in political aspect, socio-economical aspect, poverty, cultural aspects to explain the situation. It's not so easy to explain just like that. That's what I was trying to say. Regarding gender, personally, my position is that, of course, I feel concerned as an African woman. But at the same time, also, it's very difficult every time when people speak about African women or the situation of African women, it looks like none of us is happy. And that's not true. I'm sorry. It's not true. I'm happy. It's true. And people are doing, okay, white women or African people, women from North countries, they are doing marches. I don't think we need marches in Africa, but this is my personal opinion, of course, because we have our own way to deal with things and so on. It doesn't mean that we are not exposed to violence and things like that. That's not what I'm saying, but as when I see the reproductive health problem, just to have access to basic care, that's what I'm interested in. How to avoid that a girl being involved in early marriage, early pregnancy, because I know that there are consequences for her health. That's what I'm interested in. And I know that many girls, when they have access to school, they focus on their future. They don't see things as somebody who will be dependent, will try to find just a husband to take care of her and things like that. So what I want to say, I'm not sure that the girls in Africa are different from somebody like you or other girls in that room. You see what I mean? So because most of the time, the easy way to explain things is to say it's because of the culture. I totally disagree. Culture can explain things on one side, but it cannot explain everything. When things happen, even in France, many women, whatever they are, medical doctors, parliamentarians, political or whatever, some of them are beaten every day. They just shut their mouth, not because they don't want to speak about it. They would like to speak about it, but sometimes you look at the kids, you don't want to divorce because of the kids and things like that. So this is just human beings' concern. So I think it's important to say that just maybe a last thing about the gender, even the gender concept. The gender concept sometimes it's like this what happened during the at the beginning of the epidemic, since it was perceived sometimes as something coming from the north, like governance, democracy, or things like that. And often people in Africa say, this is not for us. Even in UNFP or international organizations where they are developing gender programs, gender-based programs, gender analysis, gender mainstreaming, if you have men in the office who will tell you, I don't believe in your gender stuff, but they are paid on that money, tell me how it will work. So I think it's beyond the concept, what do we want? We need to rethink also those concepts in the African context. We cannot only say gender, 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 because when you see the women in Africa, when they are pregnant, they really face concrete problems. What they want, they don't want speeches. They want these concrete needs to be addressed first. After, you can sit and discuss with people. But first, if when somebody is angry, he cannot hear you, I'm sorry.
I just have another angle to that whole thing. With the whole activism in the north, there's people who are living with the virus who took it upon themselves and they fought the battle. But if you think that majority of the people in the south who are carrying the virus don't even know they're carrying the virus, who is there, who can fight? Where are you going to get that group from? Most of the time, they find out they are positive when they are in the AIDS stage, when they are almost dying. So, and that's, I think, an important thing. It's not, you don't have this large group of people who know for a long time that they're living with the virus and they have, you know, other things going to really be activists and to carry a long drawn battle. So it's also the fact that over 90% of people don't know they're living with HIV till they're almost dying.
I know there was a lady here who wanted to ask a question, and there's one at the back there. Your question was answered. So, okay, so this lady at the back.
Yeah, it's just regarding testing. I was wondering if there are that many testing centres around Africa and if the services are readily available to people. You know, because if there are no testing centres and the facilities are not available, then how do people know?
Huge dilemma. We started off, all agencies pumped in all the resources into prevention, giving out all the right information. Today, most of them are focused on care because there's so many people who are affected and who are dying. So in this whole stream of things, there's all the information being given, but there are no testing centers. So there's a town in Ethiopia where the whole town was ready to get tested if you had kids tomorrow, and they all wanted to get tested, but there were no kids in that town. They got 25 kids every week, which was enough for just the people who were dying of AIDS. So you don't have that many centers that the population needs, is what I think.
Yeah, testing is an important issue in the sense that goes hand in hand with what do you do after people are tested. Because let's not kid ourselves. I mean, we've been talking about AIDS quite a long time, and a lot of international people are talking, or in urban areas people are talking about AIDS in many countries. But AIDS is still a stigma in many societies, including in this one here. Unless you are able to provide post-testing comfort to people without jeopardizing their lives, or means to carry on their lives as it was before, I think testing is a highly ethical question to be decided according to the context. It's very one of these issues which is promoted in many areas. People go around with caravans to test this village, that village, in that particular region. But what they do is they test people here today and they move on, never to come back. And those people who are tested somehow known to the community, and they have to deal with that at the end of the day. And I don't know. A very difficult question.
I know you've already sort of answered it, but I just wanted to ask why you thought mainstreaming HIV, sorry to use a bad word, but HIV/AIDS into the development agenda is bad, because if there's a stigma still attached, that could possibly help take it away. And if HIV/AIDS is a cause and a consequence of social problems and is a reason for a failure of development, why do you think mainstreaming it would be a problem?
I think if you look at the basic facts about the development in the last 50 years, I mean, it's not very hard to see that it's not a very successful process. And one of the reasons why it's not a very successful process is because of the mechanisms through which development has been undertaken. And if you incorporate something as central as AIDS to people's lives into that quite imperfect and fairly counterproductive process, what you will end up is actually exacerbating the already existing situation. I mean, to an extent, it has already happened. Now it is very hard to see any development NGO nearly which is not working in AIDS area, HIV/AIDS sensitization, conscientization, and all these things. But if you look at what actually they are doing, is extremely dubious. And one example of this is, as Brigitte mentioned earlier, treatment, or the possibility of treatment, is clearly very important for prevention. And for us, most of the NGOs trying to prevent people having, spreading the HIV/AIDS are running into the problem that they are unable to say what to do. Because in order to say something for prevention, you have to say people to change their behavior. You have to say, you have to live this way. You shouldn't have children unless you do this or that. It's a very fundamental questions you are posing to people. In order to get any response in a sensible way, you have to find a way of addressing their worries. In the absence of that, which was a long time in this process, and still is in most cases, some people in some areas feel, well, if you're going to die anyway, why bother? And there's a hopelessness, which sort of moves into indifference, and then totally ignoring the fact that there is a disease. And I mean, this is, to me, a fairly depressing scenario, which has been lived through in many countries I know of. So that's the reason.
In rich countries, the figures for HIV are very low, and in poor countries, they're very high. So poverty and HIV are very clearly related. So my question is, are we ever going to be able to overcome this problem of HIV without first overcoming the problem of wealth being in one part of the world and poverty in the other? And whether we should be putting our efforts into trying to come to grips with HIV, or whether we should be putting our efforts into making people, so perhaps more efforts into people like the World Bank and IMF, who are continuing the debt, with World Trade Organization, who have exploitative trade regulations. So my question is, how far can we go in this HIV issue without addressing the bigger issue?
For a moment I saw a beautiful world there when you just talked to you of everything being equal. I think the realities are so hard to work with. A simple thing, I think, like debt cancellation, which the rich countries can do but have not done, have promised to do but have not taken any steps towards that, itself is an example of, it just shows you people aren't going to let go. People really aren't looking for equality. So in that sense, it's a sense of defeat that you feel right at the beginning of whether things will ever be equal. And the damage is done. It's not one thing. You can't do 5 or 10 things to set things right. It's almost like you have to do everything differently. You have to just change mindset. You have to change hearts. And I'm not I don't want to sound desolate, but I'm not very hopeful about that.
I think she has the response in her comments and questions, but it's a very big challenge. It's true that when you lack information, you lack education, you are more vulnerable. And if you are not, economically you are depending on somebody and you have no rights, as you said, you are not able to say no or to choose for your own life, definitely you are more vulnerable. So, and when you see in all those countries where there were war or after the war, people are still suffering, and even HIV/AIDS were used to as a weapon to rape women, but not for because of the women themselves, but it was. So it's also a security issue. So it's a very big issue. So it's not the issue of HIV/AIDS itself, but what do we do to have a better developed countries, as you said, equal? I don't know, because we are talking about gender equality. I don't know if we will manage to one day to that. Is it really equality that we are looking for, or having a better world? I don't know. But what you are saying is really, it makes a lot of sense.
I think that's the sort of the crux of the problem. Unless we deal with the problem of poverty as well as the structures which are creating poverty, i.e. the economic relations and all organizations around it, I don't think it's going to be an easy task, given that, and also it's a very, I think another issue is we are sort of in a moment which is sort of dangerous, because it happened with the environmental movement and it's about to happen with HIV/AIDS. Environment was fixed into the economy, that it is economically good to care about environment, i.e. that you then start to think, we care about environment so long as it's economically sensible. Now the discussions around development and HIV/AIDS impact on development is going that way as well. To deal with the HIV/AIDS is an economic, makes economic sense because it's good for the development of the country. But those decisions are taken extremely precariously in all these sort of international hi-ho, and it totally ignores the fact that this is a disease people live and they have to, you know, conduct their lives. And if we follow the first scenario, I think the disease is just going to spiral, because there are cases in certain countries, I heard people saying, well, it doesn't make sense to invest in HIV/AIDS because our birth rates are higher than mortality rates and that can be sustained in the next 5 years, so why we should bother to invest in HIV/AIDS? And well, clearly there's a problem.
Now, what I'm seeing is that you and another question over there.
Yeah, there's one.
Shall we take all three questions at once and then round up? Why don't we do that? So, okay, we'll take four then. Suddenly.
Yeah, I just want to make a comment, could be, and to hear your views as well. It's about the testing issue, because I wouldn't disregard testing so much. I was working in Mozambique, and the testing had a very good impact in the fact that people then knew their status and could think about how they're going to change their lives. And I would think that should be promoted more and more, and ways of how they can then cope with their lives knowing they're HIV positive and without having the treatment and the medication available. And that there should be more of an emphasis on that. And so I would very much say that testing is a good idea. I just wanted to hear a bit more about you, especially from yourself.
You are right. Testing has many advantages. The problem is that when you have also ethical, it's also an ethical issue. If you suggest to somebody to have a test, but what do you offer him after the test? If he's HIV negative, that's fine. You can offer him, I said only in quotes, information or advice. Okay, try to keep that safe and things like that. It's like in a bank. When you have money in your bank, you want the money to grow. So how do you use that as, you say, a capital? Yes, capital, and you make it grow, you see? But if the person is HIV positive, maybe she's not sick yet. She's just HIV positive, right? But you can give her advice, but she may fall in the AIDS stage. So what do you have to offer? And that's the problem in our country. Sometimes we don't even have enough kits, as she mentioned, to suggest to have people tested. And what do we offer? We don't have the antiretroviral therapy, and this is another problem. And another example of that, who really show that it's an ethical issue, is the prevention of mother-to-child transmission. Many protocols have been put in place in countries. They treat the kids, the children, but not the mother. But you have to also to test, the mother has to go under testing. And after that, what happens? And when the trials are stopped, are over, nobody cares about the mother, about what else for her after. Can she continue the treatment? She cannot continue. So this is an ethical issue. Testing, no problem. 100% agree with you. But what do you do with that? And this ethical issue, it links also to human rights in general. Human rights, they should be universal. It's not because you are coming from there, but it goes with money, it goes with so many things, it goes with power, it goes with information. It may look so obvious, but this is a reality, you see. But I agree that testing is important.
Okay, we're going to take three more. That lady there, and then you, and then
Okay. With what with the conversation that was going on with a woman that was over here in the view? Yeah, definitely. It's so easy to get caught up in the emotive aspect or just the health or just the economics of the entire HIV/AIDS epidemic that sometimes then actions become so focused as well. And even in regards to just working at micro and not at macro, or just working at macro and not at micro. And then it just makes it so hard, and it's not seeing how the environment, whether just the social environment or the actual land environment, affects poverty, which then feeds on people to act in dire straits, which then creates all these other epidemics. And it's until the problems and until our world is seen with a more holistic view, it's hard to say that steps that people are taking are really going to be effective. And it's such a sad, it's so hard to realize, to see that. But then it's also sort of liberating to realize that and say, okay, well, now I can take that. And in the work that I do, I want to try and touch all these levels.
My question is that at a local level, how difficult is it for people to group together in cultures where it's a shame culture? And also, how much effort has there been to change miseducation? Like, for example, in a lot of developing countries, people believe that if you sleep with a virgin, that will get rid of having HIV and AIDS.
Hi. The question I really wanted to ask was, how do you rekindle the North's interest in HIV/AIDS, particularly the media? Okay, Clinton tried to do it a couple of years ago when he talked about it being the biggest threat to global security. Do we now do it by focusing very much on the business implications? And it strikes me that the altruism is no longer there in the North. There is this idea about compassion fatigue, and poverty is just a concept too big for most people to grasp. But you know, over the past couple of years, the issue has just disappeared off the agenda. And there is a feeling among very senior people in the media world that, you know, AIDS is so 80s, we don't do it anymore. And I find that absolutely terrifying. So do you shift it? Do there need to be new strategies to, in a sense, scare the northern world that this is as much a problem to do with the North as it is to do with the South?
But I'm not sure that I got all what you said. I'm sorry for my English. What you are saying about this virgin, people thinking that's true, but this is the problem of all those strategies trying to address behavior change. It's difficult. None of us here in this room want somebody to tell him you have to do that, your sexuality should go in that direction or things like that. And most of the time, even medical doctors or nurses or the parents also, most of the time it's difficult for them to talk to their kids, to their adolescents. And because sexuality is taboo, it's not easy to say, to give. Giving it advice regarding sexuality is so difficult. Just an example, in Africa, in some parts of Africa, when the girl is the first time she is menstruated, the grandmother, the mother will say, "Oh, congratulations, you are a woman." What does that mean to say to a woman, to a young girl, that she is a woman? Just because she gets that's not, because you don't, explain to that girl that she can get pregnant if she has unprotected sex, she can get HIV/AIDS or STI. If nobody explains what are those biologic changes occurring in her body and what are the consequences, it doesn't make sense. So people just say, okay, you are a woman, but at 13 years old or 11 years old, your body is not mature. Your body is not prepared to to go for, to carry a baby or things like that. So it's just to show how difficult sometimes it is to say things, to explain, or we say things, but we don't see how it can impact on people. And it's important also at school, all these programs which are trying to mainstream life skills education, sexuality and things like that, that is important. But it's also important that parents are at home, or big sisters, they are able also to talk to the kids, and not because of their own shame or their own uncomfort, to be able to talk to their own kids about sexuality or pills. They cannot help them to be ready for those things in life. So it's not easy in terms of behavior change. And after that, you have this issue of sugar daddy. It's true that some of them, they thought that because HIV/AIDS is among mature women, they thought that by going with virgin, they would protect themselves from, they would prevent themselves from having HIV/AIDS. Those are that kinds of responses or strategies people put in place to avoid sex. But most of the times, it's because of lack of information. That's why it's important to address this issue.
On that same thing, it says a lot about the kind of prevention strategies that were used earlier on, and it's still continuing to be used in many parts where it was just an import of Western strategy without understanding and take into consideration local culture and local practice. You think many people in rural places hadn't even seen a condom or had no idea of a condom, and then here you had agencies coming and distributing condoms. So immediately people thought, oh, now they want us to have sex. So, you know, they're promoting promiscuity. And it's just the kind of strategies that were used were just too alien or not appropriate for each situation and culture. So, I mean, it's a struggle because it's about behavior. It's, you know, will agencies are learning, I think, to incorporate culture and see how you work around that. Media. Oh, the media is an ongoing struggle, really. It's, I don't know, I feel on one hand, there are so many issues in this world today, and in some ways, I feel, can understand why they jump from one issue to the other. I mean, today it's asylum seekers, and you know, and how do you sustain interest? I think the media is just one side of it, one side to the whole, you know, whole problem. I think it's also government. If governments did speak up, if governments did voice a concern and did say, you know, you have in the AIDS conference in Barcelona, you had Mandela and Bill Clinton just going on and on about, you know, how people need to speak up, and they were referring to the government head. And once if a leader of a nation takes that stand, then I think the media will follow. And so it's an ongoing struggle to keep media. And they want either desperately sad stories, or they want some, you know, mad stories. They don't want the reality on the ground most of the time. So you feel kind of, I don't want to give you those kind of stories that you're looking for.
I think for testing, I'll just totally agree with Bridget that fine, so long as you can provide mechanism and otherwise highly ethically do this intervention. In terms of the holistic understanding leading to a more pragmatic approach, I think that tends to be the NGO approach par excellence, in the sense that we can't deal with everything, we are not going to solve the entire problem in the world, so we'll do what we do. But that's a fairly problematic approach, because unless you forget about the environment, larger context, and if you are not planning according to that context, whatever your small contribution is, you will miss the sort of point, I think. That's the sort of consideration, particularly in terms of policy interventions. Yeah, it's very hard, I think, to bring behavioral change in societies where talking about sex, talking about personal, talking about these things in public is not a common thing to do or culturally accepted thing to do. It's very difficult to get people to talk about it and create groups or change their behavior, reach them or reach allow them to reach each other, so that's a major problem, and which is not addressed whatever in terms of behavioral change. But in terms of media, I think this is a major, major concern. Most of the journalists I met in sort of in Southern Africa, who are representing very large sort of newspapers in this country or in the US or in Europe, are traumatized with the fact that whatever they write about HIV/AIDS and send back home would be shelved, because it's not fashionable, it's not sort of the everyday interest. But it seems this is also fairly similar to what is happening in this country in terms of media approach to the recent statistics about the increase in AIDS in this society. So I think there is a major need to educate both the public and the people who are informing the public. And there are few ways to do it. And one way of doing it in the way we are trying to do it is sort of one part of the debate in terms of the academia doing it, like doing research and publicizing this. But also there is an important role for all these NGOs getting funding to work in South, in industrializing countries or developed countries, to bring their experience back into this context. Not only talk about it, but try to think how those experiences in fact are relevant to what this country is facing today in terms of HIV/AIDS. These are not fine. The groups are different, the patterns are different, but there are lessons which can be adopted and translated into a different context. And this is not happening. Everyone is doing, either in this country as a health intervention, in the health system, social policy intervention, and what we are doing in the, let's say, in Uganda is an international AIDS-related issue. So long as we keep this sort of distinction, I think it's very hard to get media's attention, because it's always about, has to be about international news. Either there's a famine, there's an AIDS, you hear about it, or in Zimbabwe, there's hunger, AIDS, whatever. Unless there's a major event in a country, we don't hear about it. So I think that sort of link between two sides needs to be done, and everyone has a role in this. I mean,
I must say that I think another factor is simply the scale of the problem. It's so enormous that people almost can't bear to contemplate it, and so they don't want to think about it. And I think that's what newspaper editors are responding to, that it's just unbearable to contemplate. And when you see these millions, literally millions, it's just impossible to comprehend. And it's very difficult to make this a problem that people feel they can play a role in, because it just seems so enormous. So I think that's another difficulty. Thank you. Thank you very much. And what I wanted to end by saying was that actually I think this has been a wonderful audience, and people have taken the whole issue very seriously, and we've had many good questions. And of course I want to thank our speakers very much. And, well, next week, for those who are interested, we'll have another lecture in this series. We've got Saskia Sashton, who's very well known for her writing on globalization, talking about global cities as a site of global civil society. And you can buy the book at a discount outside, or you can come along to another of our events next week. And one just final thing that struck me from the conversation, and one issue that we're doing this year, is going to be violence against women. And it's quite astonishing when you look at the numbers. They're much bigger than you would believe. And they're everywhere. It was very difficult to say, and this is backing up Brigitte. But again, this is why, you know, these kinds of discussions are very good, and we'll follow it up on that issue as well. So anyway, thank you all for coming, and I hope to see you next week.